Welcome to Solutions for Higher Education, a podcast by Scott L. Wyatt, president of Southern Utah University in Cedar City, Utah. To subscribe to this podcast, please visit www.suu.edu/presidentspodcast, where you will find both the audio and a written transcript for today's podcast. Hi again, everyone. Welcome to Solutions for Higher Education. I'm your host, Steve Meredith, and I am joined, as always, by the president of Southern Utah University, Scott L. Wyatt. Good morning, Scott.
And good morning, Steve.
It's always a pleasure to see you, and today we're joined in studio by a special guest. And before I turn it over to you to introduce him, I just want to say I've been in and around academic administration for close to 25 years, and our guest today is the only one I have ever met that has intercepted a pass by NFL Hall of Famer Troy Aikman. Now, to be fair, Aikman was not in the NFL when he threw that pass. However, I still think that's pretty impressive. So, who's our guest today?
So, we welcome Dr. Brad Cook. He is the provost at Southern Utah University. And welcome, Brad. We're happy you joined us.
Thank you, President. Thanks, Steve, for having me here.
So, Brad, you've already been introduced as a football star. So why don't you tell us your academic background? Tell us what your majors were and degrees. That's kind of fun.
Yeah. So I was one of those students that couldn't make up their mind. And I think it was pretty late in my junior year where I decided to major in international relations. I had some sort of vague idea to, you know, work for the State Department or in diplomacy or something, but I grew up overseas as a kid, so I was very interested in things particularly related to the Middle East. I grew up in the Middle East, grew up in Saudi Arabia as a kid, so it was a very defining period. And so in college, I ended up sort of migrating, gravitating to those subjects that related to that part of the world. So by the time I was a senior at Stanford, I sort of had enough credits to sort of put together with in international relations, just as sort of an accident, because I had to sort of had to decide on a major and with the courses that I had taken. But I had mostly had driven my academic experience by individual interest more than anything specific in the end in terms of a career. I ended up staying at Stanford and finishing a master's degree in social sciences of education, which in itself is also a very liberal sort of way to understand education. And again, I focused my research and my writing on education systems in the Middle East. And then a doctorate in Middle East studies, focusing on looking at the role of public higher education in Egypt. So I spent a lot of my academic career as a graduate student, as a doctoral student, doing field work in Cairo, Egypt, and a lot of time on university campuses in and around Cairo. So I guess in a way a bit of a billboard for the liberal arts.
Well, and the school that you studied at in England is a small, obscure place that's been around for more than 800 years.
It was funny.
Oxford, I think.
Yeah. University of Oxford. So here's an interesting story. When I was there, they were considering putting together a law school. A business school at Oxford. And the debate was, they didn't want to have a business school because they didn't want to have vocational or technical education at Oxford. They do now have a business school, but yeah. But that was kind of how sometimes out of touch places like Oxford could be.
Well, let's jump into this these words that are interesting, particularly interesting in America today, and those are the words that comprise liberal arts. And I think they're really confusing to people. English is one of those languages where words have multiple meanings, And when one of the meanings of the word has a certain connotation, it's hard to use the word in any sense without that troubling connotation, good or bad, imposing on all other meanings of the word. So what does it mean to be, what does the word liberal mean?
Yeah. So there are probably at least three dimensions of that we probably need to unpack. There are liberal arts, which typically relates to certain types of disciplines. So the liberal arts majors, so English, sociology, anthropology.
Like the Democrat Party and the Green Party and those kinds of things?
Yeah, this is where confusion reigns, I think, is the term liberal has been quite politicized. But there are the liberal arts, which relate to disciplines.
Don't have any relationship to politics.
No relation to politics at all. Then there's liberal education, which really sort of connotes a broader set of skills, right? Sort of, you know, a broad-based transferable skill set. So, you know, communication and critical thinking and, you know, ethical reasoning and all of these sorts of things that an education, a liberal education can provide. And in a way, how it started out, though, the term actually goes back to the Greeks, that when it was talked about as a liberal education, really was about education for those that were free. What is the proper education for those that weren't slaves? And, you know, often when I speak to students and parents about trying to understand or wrap their head around the term liberal in this sense, with a small L, let's emphasize, is think about it this. If I were an employer, if I were your employer, for example, and I was considering giving you a raise, would you want me to be liberal with my raise or conservative with my raise? Now, that's not a political statement. That is essentially just, you know, one that is liberally given, right? But I think that especially in the Midwest and Intermountain West, often when we bring up the term liberal arts or liberal education, it immediately connotes a political position of some stripe or another. And being in a very conservative part of the country, often that term is very problematic and often stops the thinking stops right there. In other words, it just is biased by its term.
Steve, you were talking about a Gallup poll.
Yeah, there's a Gallup poll recently where the title of the article in which it's cited is literally "Higher Education, Drop the Term Liberal Arts." The folks at Gallup decided to poll, and it's a large sample size, and they said you just have a branding problem.
This is a national poll.
It is, and employers actually really like what the liberal arts do, what they add to a student's education and to their life, but this terminology is killing you. This branding that you have is killing you, because liberal means all of the politically charged things that we've talked about, and the word arts simply means, and I can say this with all due respect to my colleagues, that you're never going to make a living, right? I mean, I want to be an artist means a big sad trombone in the heads of moms and dads everywhere, because, you know, my son is going to live in the basement forever. Is what getting a degree in the arts means.
So liberal arts quickly brings into some people's minds, or enough people that the Gallup poll found that it was a real issue, enough people's minds that this is political and non-remunerative.
Right.
I do know some very well-paid musicians.
I do too. I've always been able to make a living as a musician. In fact, when I was a department chair, I answered two questions constantly, and one of them was a mother and father or family member would bring a child to say, "We're planning to come here next year or in another couple of years, but will you please, please tell our son or daughter that they cannot make a living as a musician?" And I would always say, "No, I'm sorry, I can't." I know lots of people that make a living as a musician.
Nice
I can't
living.
Guarantee that yours will, but I know lots of people that
yeah.
that make actually a fairly prosperous living as a musician. or other artists.
So when we on a university campus talk about the liberal arts, we aren't talking about politics, and we're not talking about painting or singing.
Right.
Even though that might be included, we're talking about something different. We're talking about an education that is, as you mentioned, Brad, liberally given, broadly given, that gives students a foundation to pursue a whole variety of careers, to develop the skills that will help them be successful. What do you think the most important skills employers are looking for that are really well delivered by what we might describe as liberal arts majors?
Yeah, you and I have been in industry advisory board meetings, and these are boards that we bring in an industry specialist to advise us on our majors and our curriculum, and we'll ask them as a university, how can we best serve you and your company? And these employers will say, well, you know, we need certain technical skills and we need more engineers, but very quickly they'll follow up with, but you know what we really need? You know, we need employers that can problem solve. You know, we need employees that can write, employees that have oral communication skills, that sort of, you know, critical thinking. Others can look at a problem and think through these issues to problem solve. They often talk about how they need to have employees that are good at synthesizing new ideas, asking good questions, working in teams, and having good ethical judgment. They want people who are curious, right? They want people to add value to their company. And so these are all skills that are part of a liberal education. This is the primary goal of a liberal education. Once we call it that, it often creates consternation.
I spent time going around talking to employers in Southern Utah, and I remember one visit that really quite surprised me. I was sitting in a maintenance facility at a mine because they were giving us a tour, and the person I was talking to, in answer to my question, what can we do to help prepare people to come work for you, said, what I really want you to do is help people learn how to become leaders, because everyone I hire, whether it's a custodian, a mechanic, whatever it might be, I'm hiring a future manager. And I want everybody that comes here to have these kind of skills that you just described, Brad. I was in another mine and had the same question, and he says, well, we need them to know welding. That's important. But we can help them develop some expertise in welding. And we need them to be able to do this and to do that. But what we're struggling with is our maintenance people need to be able to read really complex materials. We need really smart people. We don't want any grease monkeys. We want intelligent people who can think, who can read, who can understand, who can problem solve, and at the same time can do welding and those kinds of things. That was really interesting. And I think that those individuals would have considered themselves politically very conservative, but what they were asking me for was a liberally trained person. And if I would have said to them, oh, you want somebody trained in the liberal arts, they would have said, oh, no, that's not what I said.
That's right.
You're confused. But it takes too much time to argue about terms. We focus really on the goal. The goal is not to convince anybody a term is right or wrong. The goal is to teach those things that lead to success and happiness for students.
Well, one way to think about this, and we talk about it here on our campus, as a T-shaped education, Right? We're the Thunderbirds, so it's a T-shaped education. And if you think about the shape of a T, you have sort of this, you have two crossbars, right? You've got a bar that goes across, which represents sort of the broad-based transferable skill sets that we're trying to give to a student. And these are all sort of the liberal education pieces that we're talking about. But that's not to diminish sort of the disciplinary depth that also employers are looking for. And so let's take accounting. People want to have accounting majors and accounting employees who know accounting. So there's a disciplinary depth there that's important. But what industries really want are accountants that not only are disciplinary competent and deep, but have these other types of skill sets that you're talking about. So the one duty I think we have as a university is to attend to both. But it's often that broad-based T, along the T axis there, that there's an awful lot of confusion and the hand-wringing when we use the word. But it is, I think, really important for an educated person to have skill sets, right, that are employable, but over a career, right? So we're not talking about just the first job. Our responsibility as a university is to think about someone's career over the course of a lifetime, that they have skill sets that are going to serve them well when they change careers multiple times. And the data is very clear that people will change. Students will change their careers 4, 5, 6 times in a lifetime. And it would be a disservice to them if we were siloing them in very narrow skill sets so that when technology changes or the workplace changes, then they're going to be unemployed because they had a skill set that now a machine can take over. So we have to think about the future. And one statistic that just blew me away, and this came from the Economic World Forum, that would say that 65% of students entering primary school today will be employed in jobs that do not currently exist. That's 65%. Are going to be employed in jobs that we don't even know about right now.
How can we possibly
prepare? So how can we do that? And yeah. I think part of that is creating these transferable skill sets, these flexibility of mind, these higher order thinking skills that students are going to need no matter what they're working or what they're doing.
AACNU did a survey just recently where they found that 93% of employers are more concerned with someone they're interviewing for a job, more concerned that individual has critical thinking skills, problem-solving skills, written and oral communication skills, than they are with this person's major. That's really quite interesting. And I read a study recently in Forbes magazine that said only 27% of college graduates are working in a field that is related to their major.
Wow, that's low.
That is incredible.
Yeah. Well, you know, I look at my kids, and that's true for them. And it's true for me that we're working in fields different than what our majors were.
You know, where I first heard that T-shaped student that Brad was referring to is in a book called Is There Life After College by a writer named Jeffrey Salingo. I really like his stuff. Here's an ad for Jeffrey Salingo. But I think he's a really great writer about issues in higher education. And where he stumbled across that term was at IBM. And he went and interviewed the man that runs all of IBM's incoming employee training. And they spend more than $1 billion a year training people in the quote IBM way so that they are IBM ready employees when they finish that initial training. And the man in charge said, we used to look for I-shaped people. We used to look for the people that knew the very, very most about their particular area. And about 15 years ago, we started to shift away, and now we're almost entirely looking for T-shaped people, people who can work with others, people who have not only great great skills that represent that center column of the tee, but they also have some pretty significant, a crossbar to reach into other areas. And you're absolutely right. Your training is as an attorney, and now you're the president of a university. Did you receive undergraduate training and graduate school training that prepared you to be the president of the university, despite the fact that they thought you were being prepared to be an attorney instead?
No, but there probably are some people that say, I knew it. I knew it. No, I think that...
But your undergraduate is in philosophy.
My undergraduate was in philosophy and econ. I had a dual major. But those two majors combined really helped me to analyze and to think and to be able to read things and understand people of different views. And I am grateful for those majors. I've never regretted it for a minute. They've been really helpful to me.
They made you more T-shaped.
Yeah, they were spectacular for me. But then I found myself when I was an attorney, I found myself always trying to, because I was doing trial work, and I'd have an expert witness who was a psychologist, and then I'd have an expert witness who was a physician, then an expert witness that was a crime scene analyst, and I had to learn as much as I could about each of these people's professions, you know, and it was more easily done with a broad basis. Brad, you've been working on something that you call badges.
Yeah, digital badges.
Talk about how this shapes out this T.
Yeah.
And then what it is.
So we were really impressed at the university by a study by Burning Glass. It's a think tank that... indicated that liberal arts majors in particular could make a significant percentage of more salary if they had some sort of identifier to employers that they had some sort of technical or vocational elements in addition to their liberal arts degree. So, if, for example, a history major having a digital badge or a certificate of sorts, somewhere between 9 and 12 credits that they could add to their CV. Often now, you know, CVs and resumes go out to employers in a digital form. And so when employers pull it up digitally, there can be this digital badge, which once clicked on will show that in addition to the degree that they have 9 to 12 credits in cybersecurity or in social media or in technical writing or in technical communications. What that helps is augment, right, these degrees with very specific skill sets. Now, that helps employers connect very quickly to what a student can do in addition to their degree. And I think this is a critical thing. And I think it's something that the country is moving towards, is what's called micro-credentialing or stackable credentialing, right, where, you know, students can stack on in their educational experience, competencies and skills in which make them that much more marketable. But a secondary element of this that attracted to me is that this is maybe in a way in which we can actually encourage students to stay in these really valuable disciplines, right? Like philosophy, that give these skill sets that we've talked about to students, so that they aren't discouraged away from moving into some of these fields, because, you know, that they can do a digital badge option within the 120 credit hours of their bachelor's degree. So we aren't asking them to extend time to graduation or add additional cost, because they can do it within the electives of their major, but come away with a degree in philosophy, but also have a digital badge, say, in technical writing or in social media or one of these other, computer science or networking or something like this. And so we're really excited, right, that students are going to have this option. And we're finding them actually more valuable to students than the minor, because the minor, it has more credits that's required, but also it's very disciplinary based. So often a liberal arts student will have a degree in English, but then have a minor in something like anthropology or ethnic studies or something. And that doesn't help employers get their mind wrapped around immediately as to what this person can do when they on the first day of the job.
So then at SUU, you were trying to take this idea of this broadly based, liberally given version of education and then infuse it with little mini majors that students can opt to take that are much more specific, much more career focused, or at least skills based focused than they might get in that broader educational context.
Yeah. And in the inverse, right? You think about our engineering students or, you know, our business students, they can also get badges that perhaps have a liberal arts element to them, right? So what we want are engineers that perhaps could get a digital badge in critical thinking, right? Or in problem solving or in technical writing, right? Or something like this. That, you know, because we want to have even our science, our STEM students, to have augmentation of their education to make them more productive. And
yes,
so it works both ways.
I've always actually thought that was the little blind spot that STEM, the big push for STEM education actually has, is that, as you said, employers will say as the very second thing out of their mouth, yes, we need these technical skills, but we also want them to write well. We also want them to present well. We also need them to have managerial skills or team building skills. And all of those things tend to be more towards the liberal arts education part of what they would do. So taking a STEM student and giving them the opportunity to be a better writer or to be a better communicator in some way, I think that's a terrific option and would make them much more interesting to a prospective employer. You've been listening to Solutions for Higher Education. Today's topic has been part one of a discussion about the importance of a liberal education. Join us again next week for part two of this same conversation with Dr. Brad Cook, the provost of Southern Utah University. Thanks for listening. Bye-bye. Thanks for listening to Solutions for Higher Education. To subscribe to this podcast, please visit www.suu.edu/presidentspodcast, where you will find both the audio and a written transcript of today's podcast. The original music for this podcast was composed by Jack Barton, a master's degree student in music technology at SUU. For more information about Southern Utah University, please visit www.suu.edu.